If you've listened to the first few episodes, you probably realize I'm working a theme here. The Infinite Inning is a crossroads that simultaneously has all the exits and none of the exits, and your challenge, as they say on Disney's Haunted Mansion ride, is to try to find a way out. Gosh, I love that ride. Let me see if, that's better. When hinges creak in doorless chambers. Actually, the Infinite Inning has a lot of doors. They just may not be the door that you want. Last week, the Atlanta Braves released veteran first baseman Ryan Howard from his minor league contract. He was hitting 184 with no power, and he wasn't really taking any walks either, and he never did have any speed or play defense. I guess they figured, given that he's 37 and coming off a 196 season, albeit one with 25 home runs, there really wasn't any point. You can't blame Howard for trying. You can't blame him for trying a lot, even if it was a great career. I mean, the guy did average almost 40 home runs a season. Even if he was a contradiction in terms, in that he was basically a DH playing in the National League, and often was an everyday guy who should have been platooned, he still had a great career. And unless you're totally obtuse, you can understand why he would do what he could to prevent it from ending. In the last show, I told a story involving the sports writer Grantland Rice. Howard's release made me think of a poem of his. Grantland Rice worked in an era in which, this is very odd, but sports writers tended to pepper their columns with poems. It's a little famous. I don't know if it's ever anthologized anywhere, but I've used it before. And I'm sorry for this, retrospectively speaking. I used it to add emphasis to a late-career Derek Jeter player comment in one of the many baseball prospectus annuals I worked on. It's titled, To Any Athlete. Rice wrote, "Why is it each or the last to find that his legs are gone, that his eyes are bad, that the quicker reflexes have left his mind, that he hasn't the stuff that he one day had. That lost youth mocks and he doesn't see the ghost of the fellow that he used to be. How can they slip from the height so far and never know that the day has gone when their eyes were fixed on a rising star with a firm foundation to stand upon? How can they slip as the comets fall and read no writing upon the wall? Caught by a stride which they used to beat, nailed by a punch that they used to block, trailing the flurry of flying feet, but dreaming still of the peaks that mock, each is the last to learn from fate that his story is finished and out of date." God, the answer, the obvious, compassionate answer, granny, you big jerk, is they're the last to know because they don't want to know. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Fog has momentarily lifted, and you find yourself in episode 4. I hope that's a good thing. It is for me. In a moment, I'll be joined by Mike Farren of SiriusXM and the Arizona Diamondbacks, and all too long ago, the co-host with me and Kevin Goldstein of the Baseball Prospectus Radio Hour on SiriusXM. He and I will talk about what Zach Greinke is really like, how a team broadcaster keeps his credibility and his job at the same time, and debate the merits of batting Alcides Escobar leadoff. This is why I like Mike Farren. I hadn't planned on saying this, but when you go through your career, when you go through life, you know, the nature of friends is that they move in and out, and some of them prove to be very contextual, very contingent. Some are reliant on being constantly serviced by you. You have to be in touch every second, or you might as well be dead. You have to be employed in the same place, or you might as well not exist. You have to be doing them constant favors. And I think we've all had the friend who, when you realize that you could no longer tolerate, at the sake of your own sanity, spending 3 hours on the phone a night with Brad talking about Brad's relationship problem or Brad's job problem or Brad's freaking incontinence or whatever the heck was up with Brad, that Brad would no longer be there for you because you, by putting in that time, earned nothing. And whereas you thought you were doing it because you cared about Brad and Brad cared about you, and someday Brad would repay the favor, perhaps when you had relationship problems or job problems or, God forbid, were incontinent. In fact, as soon as you cut off the empathy supply, Brad was going to go pinwheeling off into the stars so that he can latch on vampire style to the next victim for emotional succor and sustenance. And I'm going to steal a word from Edgar Allan Poe here, nepenthe. And sure, you gave selflessly, but empathy should be a two-way street, and it turns out that it wasn't. I've known Mike Farron for a lot of years. I don't know how many at this point. And we've worked together, and we've socialized together on many occasions, but I don't see him often, and we don't talk all the time, and we might exchange the odd email, but our main form of contact is that from time to time, I'll be driving along listening to his show, and he might say to Jim Duquette, "Where in history would there be another manager who would pinch hit for his first baseman in the first inning of a game?" And I'll text him and I'll say, "Casey Stengel." And then a week or two might go by and I'll be driving along and listening. And he'll say, "Where would there be another manager who would pinch hit for a guy who'd just gone 4-for-4 in the seventh inning of a game with the bases loaded?" And I'll text him and I'll say, "Casey Stengel." And I never get to stay in the car long enough to hear whether he actually uses that stuff or not. But he's nice enough not to tell me to stop bothering him during programs. I think he's okay with it. But here's the cool thing. As I said, there are people who, when you're not in constant contact with them, you don't exist. And you can't rely on them. And whatever you've done for them in the past, or even what they've done for you in the past, it's like a blank slate. It's all wiped clean. And yet, when I wrote Mike this week and said, "Would you consider taking some time out of what really is a busy schedule to appear on my new podcast series," he wrote back 2 words, "Of course." That's why you'll never hear anybody say a bad word about Mike Farron. Before we bring in this wonderful guy, I want to talk about a player who was celebrated in his day and is an obscurity now. His name is Johnny Cooney. Between pitching, playing the outfield and first base, managing briefly, coaching endlessly, and even umpiring one game when the umpiring crew failed to show up until the second inning, he had a major league career which spanned most of 43 years. It's a heck of a run, but in some ways it's a triumph of flash over substance. And that scares me in a way. It makes me think of my own experience. When I first went to college, I learned that most of my fellow freshman classmates, I should say many, not most, had not been taught to write well, which was an emphasis where I went to school, and a skill of mine. I'm not bragging on that. There are many people who write more fluidly, stylishly, and imaginatively than I do, but I had the basic facility to make words march around the page in order, and that's something that a lot of kids didn't have at that time. In one of my early history courses, I was assigned a research paper. I've come to love doing research, but at the time I was somehow, being young, a little intimidated by it. I didn't want to spend the hours in the library. I blew it off, and I wrote what was more of a polemic than a research paper. On the origins of the Cold War, I had to make a case for that. When I got it back from the professor, his comment said, "This is a tendentious, argumentative, under-researched paper. You didn't really do the assignment, but it's beautifully written and a joy to read, B+. And a light dawned on me, and I knew I was going to be okay in college. I knew I was going to do just fine. As long as I could make my assignments sound good, they didn't have to be good, because a lot of people were doing them the other way around, or neither. I outgrew that attitude rapidly because I soon understood that I wanted to be a writer, and professional pride meant that I had to be both, and that I wouldn't put anything under my name that wasn't both. I think, I hope. That's why I want to talk about Johnny Cooney. Because Cooney, on one level, is very, very cool. On another level, he was kind of a waste of space. In 9 years as a pitcher, he had a total of 9 WAR. In almost 1,200 games as a hitter, he had another 8. That's not a heck of a lot of production. He was precocious. He reached the majors at 20 years of age. With the Boston Braves, he was a left-handed pitcher. He got batters out with a hesitation pitch. It's since been outlawed. He would wind, rock forward, and stop, and then throw. Umpires wound up having arguments with hitters where the hitters would say, "That's a balk," and the umpire would say, "It's not a balk, there's nobody on base." And the batter would say, "It's still a balk," but they'd be out. The problem was, he couldn't stay healthy. He ultimately had an arm surgery where they took a whole bunch of pieces of bone out of his arm. It sounds like almost randomly, like, "Say, Bob, does this chunk look like it belongs in an arm to you?" "Darned if I know, Ralph." "Well, I'll just saw it out anyway and toss it in that bowl over there." Click. His pitching arm ended up 3 inches shorter than his non-pitching arm, and that was pretty much the end of his pitching career. But he had already started to fill in around the diamond while he was nursing that arm, playing a little bit of outfield and first base, and he could hit. He made terrific contact. He never walked, and his power was pretty much non-existent, but he could play a very good outfield. With the Braves, one of his teammates is a veteran outfielder, the same guy that I text Mike Farron about, Casey Stengel. And this is significant because when Cooney goes down to the minors to rebuild his career, he ends up playing for Casey, who's managing the Toledo Mudhens of the American Association. And Casey convinces Cooney that with his skill set, he should spend each at-bat shooting for the foul lines. Casey looked at this guy and sees he's 5'10 and he's got a mismatched pair of arms, and he's not going to be slugging 30 home runs a year regardless. So he explains to Cooney that the secret to success is that if you shoot it down the lines, you've only got 2 players in your way, the first baseman and the third baseman, whereas if you're trying to drive the ball up the middle, there are 3 players who can get you out. Cooney buys it completely, and it works. Pretty much any possibility of Cooney hitting a home run is annihilated. But he can hit for a real good average. Casey goes back up to the majors as a coach and eventually takes over as manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers. In 1935, Cooney is still down in the American Association with the Indianapolis Indians, and he hits .372 to lead the league. Casey picks up his contract. Somebody asks him, "Who'd you just get?" He says, "Cooney." "Which Cooney is that?" "Johnny." "The same Johnny who used to pitch for the Braves?" "Yep." "He must be 35 years old by now." Casey says, "Yep, but he's leading the league in hitting, and he can play a better center field than anybody in the National League." Back then, baseball men were always looking for a steal, and scouting was in such a primitive state that you could kind of do it. So you'd bring up a guy who was 35 and hope that you'd discovered something that no one else had seen. In this case, it was sort of true. Once Cooney got back to the majors, his career average was .286. He had a .328 on-base percentage, and he slugged .344. That's an 88 OPS plus, according to Baseball Reference. It's not good. He hit a grand total of 2 career home runs, both in 1939 in back-to-back games at the Polo Grounds against the Giants. I wish I could tell you that he hit them off of Carl Hubbell and Hal Schumacher, because that would make the story even better, but no, he hit them off of Gunboat Gumbert and Bill Lorman. That's not to say he was always totally without value. He wound up back with the Braves after his Dodger stint, with Casey again. He had the ability to cover the huge outfield they had at Braves Field, or the Beehive, or whatever they were calling it, depending on the year and how they were trying to sell themselves. And he did sometimes hit a little bit over those averages. In 1939, he hit .318 and finished 3rd in the National League batting race. And in 1940, he more or less repeated at .319, and this time he finished 2nd. Those were positive years. And more than that, fans loved him. When he got traded out of Brooklyn to the Cardinals, who immediately dropped him, which is kind of an odd thing. They didn't want him. They wanted the other guys in the move, or they really wanted to get rid of Leo Durocher, is what it was. But that's the subject of another podcast and possibly a book. Fans were outraged. No one keeps you around from 1921 until 1964 unless you're a great guy. He certainly seems like the kind of player who pushed his team towards winning by contributing off the field, say, in the clubhouse. Although his teams never did win anything in the broader sense, that wasn't his fault. They were spectacularly impoverished teams with incredibly ill-equipped owners. But that doesn't make up for the fact that the people around him looked at the gloss, the batting average, and didn't see the overall lack of production. In other words, Cooney could have a long career looking good rather than being good. He was just like that paper that I finessed my way through in college, and in my heart, I still haven't lived down. And that's frightening. I mean, 20 years, 1921 to 1944, in the major leagues, and we can look back now and say,
Imagine living long enough to see your own career regarded that way, where for all your efforts, people just look and say, well, he certainly got his chances, but all of it was empty calories, and if you forgot about it altogether, you wouldn't be missing much. If a time traveler dropped by and told you that that would be true, would you stop doing what you loved and switch to something else on the off chance that your career might have more meaning? Me, I think I'd keep doing what I'm doing. I love it too much. And besides, you never know, you could get better. I'll be back with Mike Farron in just a moment. Mike, it's good to talk to you.
It's great to be with you, Stephen. I remember those long Sunday nights we used to spend together on the radio, curled up in front of the fire. Those were great times.
And isn't it funny that you and I are still the ones in the business, and Kevin Goldstein, who was the third part of that trio, has left it?
Yeah, I mean, he went and got a job with a team, which is crazy. I went through this run for a while where everybody I worked with seemed to get hired by the Astros. Morgan Ensberg, I used to do nights with, and he ended up getting hired as one of their minor league instructors. And then Kevin got the job as now the pro scouting director with Houston. And I'm so happy for him. And you know, he's been a great friend for a long, long time. And
ditto.
It's been a really, really good run for them. And boy, they're a pretty good team, aren't they?
They are, and they took a couple of other guys for their analytics department that Kevin and I used to work with it, and you too at Baseball Prospectus, like Mike Fast and Colin Wires, and it certainly seems to be paying off now.
Yeah, it does, and I think, you know, again, it comes down to, as always, right, it comes down to talent procurement, right? How do you get your talent? And as much has been made of how, you know, they were fortunate to have three number one picks overall in a row, I think it's more that they've done a really good job of spreading out the money that they received with that and trying to add as many players as possible. And, you know, they've put themselves in a really good position to be good for a number of years. And I certainly think based on the start, you got to consider them, if not the favorite, one of the favorites in the American League.
Absolutely. So I've got to ask you, aside from friends of ours who have gone on to better places, before talking to you today, I was perusing your biography.
Uh-oh.
I noticed that both you and Ronald Reagan had your first broadcasting jobs in Iowa. And his was even a baseball broadcasting job. As I think you know, he recreated games. So what I wanted to say to you, Mike, is tell me that this parallels don't end there. Tell me that you will be running, that we can declare your candidacy right here today, and that you are the man to save the republic.
Well, I will be running for governor of the state of California. No, I think that's where the parallels end. Yeah, I mean, because I didn't actually do baseball in Iowa. I never did. I was my first play-by-play gig was USHL hockey, and I covered hockey, and I covered juniors hockey, by the way, and and then dirt track auto racing. So at the Dubuque and Farley Speedways. It's, I guess, funny in that we both had gigs in Iowa. I think he was in Des Moines, right?
Davenport.
He was in a much bigger market he started in Davenport. Okay, so he started in Eastern Iowa too. But I think that that's probably about where the similarities end. I will not be running for public office. I'm much too happy just being a lowly broadcaster.
Well, there's nothing lowly about it, and that's wonderful, the way that you've ascended and made your way through a career that for a lot of people seems very transient. Over the course even of my career, where despite our work together, I've done more radio hits than radio hosting, and yet I've had spots with guys who, you know, week after week, month after month, they would say, hey, we like having you on. Can we, you know, have you on as a recurring spot? And yet those things would even go away, not so much because I blew it, at least I don't think so, but because those guys would lose their positions, just their stations would cut them. And it does seem like just kind of normal for the business that people kind of go through like shooting stars, and then maybe they don't rebound to the same effect.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a result based industry like baseball, right? So, I mean, if you don't have ratings results or whatever it is that you know, your organization is looking for, you know, you're going to have to move on. And sometimes it's, you know, you're also dealing, because we are entertainers first and foremost in broadcasting. You're dealing with an ego-driven business, and you know there are a lot of people who have egos that don't like being told what to do, even by bosses, that can lead to poor relationships and that can, you know, hasten departures as well. So I mean, I think there's a lot of things that help to create it. I've been really fortunate in my time that till now, and knock on wood, you know, I don't screw it up, I've been able to pick, you know, when it was time to move on. I've been lucky that the last, you know, 17 years or 18 years of my life, I've basically worked for, you know, three people, and two of them I'm working for currently. So, you know, I think that that's, I consider myself extremely fortunate, because I've seen, you know, many, many friends who I think are talented broadcasters, who are good people, who are not those ego-driven folks, who've been moved along for whatever reason it may be. And I always, like, I ache for them in that situation. And I, right. I realize that there's very likely that will happen to me at some point through, you know, nothing that I've done necessarily, other than difference of opinions. And that's the real tough part, is making sure that it doesn't get personal in that, because everybody, when you get new management, you know, just like we see with baseball teams, right? You hire a new general manager, new general manager is going to want to hire their own manager, their own scouting department, all of that. You're going to see turnover and change.
So do you think that a guy, I know these are outliers, I mean, these are huge historical outliers, but a guy like, and again, I'm not trying to put pressure on you by this comparison. I'm just invoking this as an example. Vin Scully started as the third man in a three-man booth where Red Barber was the number one guy, and he ends up, notwithstanding the fact that his team changed coasts, he ends up in the same place for 100 years. Harry Callis is with the Phillies for 100 years. So to what extent, though, and obviously those guys are incredibly talented broadcasters, is that luck and just being able to go along and get along and not create too much trouble when there are those changes? And how much of it is talent that just they were too good to fire at some producer's whim a little bit later on?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably a little bit of both. I would think that, you know, let's talk about Vin, because Vin is the, you know, the greatest of all time. Or, you know, and even if you want to talk about other broadcasters from a similar generation, you know, you want to, and we can go to other sports too. You know, Vern Lundquist, you know, just retired from SEC broadcasts. He's been on CBS for forever, for as long as I can remember, right? The number one thing that they had was credibility with their audience. And it's very difficult to replace that. And then once, you know, they also had stable bosses. And so in Vin's case, you know, he had the O'Malley family for years and years and years. And by the time ownership changes happened, you know, he was so established and ingrained in the Dodgers community that there was no, right. Like, I mean, you remember the firestorm that happened when was it Bo Schembechler that fired Ernie Harwell in Detroit? Like,
yes.
Could you believe that that would happen? Because Ernie was more Tiger baseball than most of the Tigers players. You know, I mean, he's more Tiger baseball than Al Kaline. You know what I mean? If you think about it. And
right.
And so to see that happen, you know, that's I mean, hopefully the executives at you know, both Fox and then with the McCourts and now obviously with the current ownership group there, you know, realize that that would be a huge mistake. And so that helps. So part of it is the stability of your bosses. And I think that that's, you know, a healthy part of the equation. But overall, I think it's that you have to be really good at your job in order to stay there. And I think that there are a lot of people that are good at their. That's not to say that you know, just being good at your job ensures you're there. There also has to mean that the opportunity is right for you. You know, there are some people that I think are really talented that move around to job every few years or are always looking for the next job because that's what they want. That's what keeps them going. They're right. Looking to take that next step up. And that's not for everybody. And I think if you find a home, you know, Vin wasn't from Los Angeles, but that became his home. He grew up a Giants fan, right? I mean, but he was a Dodger. Harry Callis is from Chicago, you know, but he found a home in Philly. And, you know, that became a huge part of his identity. And he loved it there. And, you know, just the examples that, you know, you cited. I mean, Jack Buck, you know, with the Cardinals for so many years. So I think all of it kind of comes together. There's no one set answer. But again, I mean, it's you have to have the faith of your bosses. And beyond it, you just have to consistently do a good job.
I hadn't planned to go here, but since we're talking about classic broadcasters, and you're now in the position of being a major league broadcaster, both pre, post game, and doing the odd play by play bit. You know, Red Barber, who I mentioned before, mm-hmm. is considered almost kind of the grandfather of the industry. He was the first really erudite, smooth broadcaster. And as you know, he too moved around. He went from the Dodgers to the Yankees, and he got canned. And he got canned by the Yankees for a very specific reason. I'm sure you know that as the team went down in the standings after 1964, he was told in no uncertain terms, do not refer to the fact that we are not drawing right now. Do not refer. Instead, he did talk about it, and they showed empty seats in the ballpark. And they, even though he was a New York institution, they just cut him. So you are... when you're doing a team broadcast, you are, if not directly employed by the team, you are working for a media rights holder. There has to be a good relationship with the team for that to continue. I know, having worked with Yes for 100 years myself, how that works, how people get very twitchy when you get critical. And sometimes team executives will interfere. And at the same time, somebody like Barber, somebody like you, somebody like me, might feel that they have a journalistic obligation to actually say what's happening, say... And you must have confronted this in some ways last year, which was so difficult compared to this year for the Diamondbacks when they go 69-93, to talk about the reality of what's happening. So how do you balance that? How do you balance kind of the ethics of what you're doing with the reality of how you're employed and who has to be approving of you?
Well, okay, so I'm actually a team employee. And you're right, there's two different ways that broadcasters work. They're either employed by the media outlet or they're employed by the team. I'm employed by the team, and I'm fortunate that, for the most part, the team stays out of our way. I shouldn't say for the most part. They entirely stay out of our way. I mean, you have an obligation to your audience to report the facts. You know, in the end, I've always loved Pat Hughes, the Cubs broadcaster, the way he opens a broadcast. He says, you know, it's from wherever... you know, gives the name of his analyst, and he says, Pat Hughes reporting. Well, that's what your job is. You are, in essence, reporting the facts for the record of what's occurring on the field. You know, that's the basis of your job. And I think the biggest thing is that, you know, facts don't lie, right? Whether we like them or not, facts are facts. And if a team isn't playing well, if you say a team isn't playing well, your listeners understand that, your viewers understand that, and you have credibility with them because you see the same thing that they do. The way to handle it is to not be a dick about it. I mean, that's where most people run afoul, right? I mean, if you're a jerk about things, then you're gonna run into an issue. And I think that's where you run afoul of, you know, where people run afoul of players or management or, you know, whatever, is that they do it in a fashion that's really kind of being a jerk. The Diamondbacks didn't play well last year. They were a bad defensive team. They were the worst pitching team in the National League, and they had the lowest attendance in franchise history. And all of those things suck. But we're fortunate that we have bosses that understand that all of those things stink, but they're still the facts of the matter. And I do think that when you run into problems, and there certainly are, you know, teams that are like that, that don't want you to, you know, necessarily, they want you to, you know, what's the old adage about putting makeup on a pig, right? You know, like that they want you to continue to try and do that. And there's only so much that you can do before you're, credibility, you know, takes a hit. And I think, you know, I'm fortunate in that in our booth, our broadcaster Greg Schulte has been here since the very beginning of the team, and he has incredible credibility because he's been in the Phoenix market since 1979. So he has a huge connection to the market and to people, and he's a tremendous guy. Tom Candiotti's been doing the color analysis for a dozen years now. Again, huge credibility, connection to the team, all of this, right? And so it makes it a lot easier for them to be able to you know, say what's good and what's bad. And, you know, frankly, I don't know that I think as a broadcaster, you have to weigh that, too. You know, if you're being put in a position where you feel like your credibility is being challenged because your bosses don't want to admit to what the facts are, you know, it's OK for you to say that that job isn't for you then. Because I know that that is very difficult in, you know, especially positions, and it's easier to say, I guess, when you have a job. But what if you're a broadcaster for a team, or, you know, you're doing national broadcast or whatever, and you don't like the direction that it's going, well, you don't have to do it. You know, you can walk away, and to me, that's the biggest thing, is that the only thing that you have is your name and your credibility.
Well, as you know, and I've seen this happen particularly in baseball, and I'm sure you've seen it too, people go through their lives, particularly now, dreaming of working for a ball club, whether it's in the front office or in broadcasting as you are. And when you achieve your dream, and then it turns out for whatever reason, your dream, the reality of your dream is not what you thought it would be. And in fact, I mean, let's say your boss is wherever your boss is a complete jerk, for example, and it's just not a tenable position. It is very, very hard to give up on that dream and go do something else, whether it's in the industry or not. There are a lot of unknowns. Yeah. And the temptation is to just hang on by your fingernails and just hope it gets better because you've had this fantasy for so long.
Sure. And I think that goes across all industries. You know, my wife had a job that on paper seemed like it was a dream job. It was something that would be incredible. And the job was a nightmare. And she was miserable at it. And her leaving that job made her much happier in the end. I mean, just because you build something up in your head to be a certain way doesn't mean it's going to work out that way. And I think that that's really difficult. You're right. I mean, it's if you see something and it's like, man, this is going to be great. This is, you know, I'm never going to leave this place. This place is going to be awesome. Well, there could be changes that occur, too, that, you know, make it less awesome. And you can't be afraid of, you know, in the end, your dreams can change. Right. I mean, just because you've had this dream since you were 12 years old or whatever it is to do whatever, it doesn't mean that it has to continue to be your dream when you're 40.
No, that's true. And I would hope, whether you keep to that dream or not, that as we all evolve and age, that we can have the creativity and the resilience to invent new dreams. Mm-hmm. But let me ask you this. And if this is uncomfortable, because I'm going to mention a specific name, then let me know. But this, again, goes to sort of the rock and a hard place that a broadcaster or team broadcaster can find themselves in. I am fascinated, and admittedly at a distance, with Marty Brenneman and Joey Votto and the way that there seems to be an animus there and a refusal to appreciate the way that the player plays. And as a historian, I can look back at newspapers from the 1940s and see that Ted Williams got exactly the same grief for exactly the same reason. And it's very odd that so many years later, someone is kind of reenacting this. It seems odd to me. And again, you're more familiar with the dynamics of this. And if these are things that you can't comment on in some way, then let me know. But I'm just speaking generally. It seems odd to me that either the player wouldn't say, and maybe Votto doesn't care, you know, look, I'm on a long-term contract. I want to be comfortable here. I don't feel like being subject to friendly fire on team broadcasts. Or alternatively, that somebody with the team wouldn't say, this commentary is off base. It's not a question of journalistic ethics here. It's just a question of a weird kind of obsession, and we need it to stop.
Well, I mean, Marty's been there a lot longer than Joey Votto has. So keep that in mind. I mean, Marty's been there for 40 some odd years. You know, I think one of the reasons why Marty is in the Hall of Fame is that he's opinionated. He speaks his mind, whether we agree with it or not. Votto certainly isn't the first player that he's been critical of. You know, there are a lot of players. There are a lot of really good players who were there for a long time that Marty was not afraid to call out when he felt like they weren't performing to their level of standard or whatnot. I do think that Marty is a bit unique in that anymore, in that, you know, that may have been something more from his generation of broadcaster. And, you know, again, Marty got there in what, the early 70s, if I remember right, you know, or before that. You know, Harry Carey certainly had no problem criticizing players and whatnot.
Right.
So you don't see it very often anymore. And I think it's part of stylistic differences. But you're also talking about an extremely popular and good broadcaster that's who he is. And if, listen, I understand if I were Joey Votto, I'd be ticked off too. But if I'm Marty and that's my personality and that's who I am, I mean, Marty's basically sharing who he is with his audience every day, right? I mean, there's no false pretense to him. There's nothing phony about it. And it doesn't mean it has to be for everybody, but that's who he is. And I would be more irritated if Marty Brenneman couldn't be Marty Brenneman on a broadcast. You know what I mean? Like, just like, you know, listen, he doesn't like the way Joey Votto, you know, takes pitches. Okay, that's fine. But I also, you know, you also have to be understanding of the fact that if you were to take away that ability to criticize from Marty, he wouldn't be Marty anymore. So I think it's a two-way street to some degree, and I think, you know, that's why the guy's in the Hall of Fame, and he's you know, he's one of the great broadcasters of all time, and there will never be another guy like Marty.
Has a player ever asked you about something that you've said on the air?
No, but I don't do that many games either. You know, I'm the backup, so, you know, it hasn't happened to me yet. It may at some point, and I try and show my face in the clubhouse every day so that if I do say something that somebody runs afoul that is upset about, I'm there and accountable, because that's all you can be.
Related to being in the clubhouse, I just want to ask you this one kind of inside Diamondbacks question. Mm-hmm. We're talking a couple of days, I think about 3 days after Zenk Greinke had this great 8 one-hit innings against the Pirates. It was a no-hitter, I think, for 7. He's off to a great start after a really miserable spring training, so that's wonderful to see. But he, for those of us outside who are just watching him on a fan basis, he's always been an enigmatic guy and a guy who's portrayed as standoffish. And I was just curious, having observed him up close, what your impressions of him are.
Yeah, I don't think standoffish is the right word. I don't really have a relationship with Zach, so I'll be, you know, frank in that. In part because he just doesn't spend much time talking to reporters or broadcasters other than after his starts, and I have post-game duties. So we really don't have a relationship at all. I think that's the perception of him as his, I guess, his front-facing, right? I mean, when you face fans or the media or whatnot. But with his teammates, I don't believe that he's standoffish. I mean, here are the things that I know. He loves baseball. He loves to research baseball. He has a very inquisitive mind. He loves to talk about baseball. And he is more than willing to sit down with his teammates and have discussions with them about anything. He's, you know, I think the word leader gets thrown around an awful lot, but you expect good players to be able to share their craft with others, right? And I certainly think that Zach does that. And, you know, he really is in tune with how to make adjustments and how to become a better pitcher. You know, he struggled early last year. And then he went on a 10-start run in the middle of the season where he was really good until he got hurt. And once he got hurt, he was never quite the same. He missed 2 months and then came back. He ended up dinging up his shoulder towards the end of the year. You know, this year he got off to a little bit of he had a couple of good starts, struggled against Los Angeles, and made an adjustment, you know, where now his slider is probably better than it's been in a number of years, where he's been, you know, mostly the changeup has been his best secondary over the last several seasons. He's a very adaptable pitcher, and he's very, you know, he's very in tune with what he needs to do to get hitters out. And I think that along with his willingness to talk about the game with his, you know, colleagues, you know, really makes him a valuable asset in a clubhouse.
That you use adaptable to describe him, I think, seems really apt. And one of my favorite things about him, and this goes back to when he was in the minors, there was a profile of him, I think, in Baseball America, and in a series of starts, his strikeouts had dropped off. And I think the general manager was still Dayton Moore at that point. And Dayton Moore called him and said, "Hey, we noticed that you're not whiffing as many batters as you were. What's going on?" And Greinke said, "Oh, do you want more strikeouts? Because I can do that if you want more strikeouts." And that's such a wonderful thing that he could just, you know, "I was experimenting a little. It was just a slightly different approach. You know, I was being more efficient. But if you want that, you know, I'll give them to you."
Yeah, I think that speaks to the way he kind of views the game. I mean, he's an extremely smart pitcher in that he's very good at finding his strength that exploits a hitter's weakness, right? And going back to that until, you know, that hitter makes the adjustment. You know, we always talk about adjustments is a term that gets used a lot in baseball. And then most of the time I really hate it because it's used as a catch-all, right? You never actually get the description of what the adjustment is. So let's take the no-hitter that he had going, for example, right? Gregory Polanco was the guy who broke it up. And Greinke, in the first time he faced him, had an 11-pitch at bat. And he kept working him in that at bat. Just coming inside. Fastball sliders, in. I think he flipped up maybe one curve. I don't have my chart in front of me. Go to that third at bat, that the at bat that Polanco got him, right? he kept coming inside again, right? In. And Polanco hit a long foul ball, home run distance, but foul on a fastball, and then kept a slider fair, and that was the first hit. And Greinke talked about it after the game, and he said, yeah, I kept trying to come in, and basically he said, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but he was like, basically he made the adjustment before I did. That's, that's an awareness that you need, right? I mean, so now we'll look in 2 weeks, and I'm not sure if Greinke's on the schedule to face Pittsburgh in the series there Memorial Day week, but I'll be really curious to see how he adjusts to pitching Gregory Polanco the next time, because you get an idea basically from what he said after the game. We were trying to come in a lot and he finally got to us. Okay. So he's got long arms, right? I mean, Gregory Polanco is a long limbed guy. So let's see how they attack him next time. I'm going to be really curious to see that as well. So you will see what the adjustment is like for Greinke, but he was smart enough to realize what he needed to do next, or at least that there needed to be a change in the plan the next time.
Let me ask you a bit about the pre- and post-game role, because I'm really fascinated by that. Mm-hmm. I'm somebody who has listened to, particularly in my formative baseball years, an insane amount of baseball on the radio, because as cable rose and games started moving off of free TV, my father was adamantly opposed to cable. I'm not, freedom or the Great Depression or something. So I listened to, growing up in New Jersey, a lot of Yankees, a lot of Mets, and some Phillies also. And it was wonderful to observe the different styles of everybody. Parenthetically, I'll add in that as great as Harry Callis and Richie Ashburn were on those Phillies broadcasts, they had a very ascetic style on the radio. It worked on television because they would rotate. They would do like 3 and 3 and 3, right. TV, radio, TV. And I used to call it tea with the Phillies because they never said anything. You would just hear crowd noise and then you hear the pitch and you just hear ball. And they would, if you turn on the station at the wrong moment, you would think that you had just gotten static because it was so dry. But I used to listen to Howie Rose a lot, and now he does play by play for the Mets, but he did the pregame for a number of years, and that had a number of unique stresses to it. And the first one that I'm very curious about, and I've listened to you do this, is the pregame hit with the manager, because. Mm-hmm. When Buddy Harrelson became manager of the Mets, he terminated that exchange after a number of weeks or months because he felt that the questions were too hard or too mean. I lost a lot of respect for him. Obviously, he didn't have a long career as a manager, but it seemed like a leading indicator that maybe you're not meant to do this if you can't have like a 5-minute chat with a broadcaster at the outset of the game.
Yeah, so, that's interesting because I've been fortunate in that. Well, I mean, first of my job at Sirius, I've been interviewing managers, multiple times a week for a number of years. Right. So I guess I'm kind of comfortable with it in that regard. But in both managers that I've worked with here in Arizona, and first Chip Hale and then now Torrey Lovello, that they're pretty open with me. And I think that they get the job of, when you're the pregame host, you're not playing gotcha, right? I mean, you're setting up the game. You're talking about what happened last night. You're setting up what's going on tonight, right? I mean, it's very much just the facts. And I do think that there is a balance to, how you ask the questions or what you ask. There are a lot of questions that I will ask when the door is closed without a microphone on that may be of some of the more critical decisions of the night before, so I have an understanding of what to do. Because I understand that asking a confrontational question in a pregame interview probably doesn't lead to a very good pregame interview. but I still want to get the information, right? So I think a lot of it has to do with, how you go about it. I think I've been real fortunate, and then you have two managers there. I mean, Chip had managed or had coached in New York, so, I mean, he certainly understands the role of media. Torrey had coached in Boston. He understands the role of media. And it's a little different when you're a team employee, too, in that you're on the same team to some degree, right? I mean, we're not playing, but we have the same people are writing our checks. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know that I've asked him anything particularly confrontational. Maybe I'll have to try and see what happens. But I don't think in that case. I mean, but I also think it's how you approach it. I mean, again, it goes back to what I said before. If you're a jerk about it, you're going to get a reaction from somebody who's on the defensive. And the beauty of the pregame chat is that the emotions aren't nearly as raw as they are postgame. Postgame interviews suck. Like, they suck to do, especially after a tough loss. Like, that's really hard because if you think about it, your job as a reporter, if you take off the team hat. I'll put my serious one back on. Your job as a reporter is to get the facts and get the information, right? Ask the questions that get the information as to what happened. And you're dealing with a person whose livelihood depends on wins and losses, and something occurred in that game to cause them to lose it, right? Whether by their own doing or a mistake by somebody else. And players, coaches, managers, inside that three-hour window, from that time that first pitch goes to the time the last out is recorded, it's a very emotional process. And to have 10 minutes of cool down afterwards and then have to be asked those questions right away, I mean, that's, I don't envy them in that spot. I don't know how I would, I think of myself as a pretty calm individual. I don't know how I'd react to that. You know, I mean, like, you're being questioned. Can you imagine blowing a save and then, you know, blowing a 3-run lead in the ninth and then standing up in front of reporters 10 minutes later and being with them basically asking you, why'd you ruin it for your team? Like, I mean, like, my God. And those guys who do it consistently, and we're fortunate here in that, you know, Fernando Rodney, I know, is one of the more adventurous finishers in baseball.
Indeed.
But is one of the most stand-up guys. Like, he's ready. He gets ready, and, like, the clubhouse doors open, and Fern's at his locker and ready to answer the questions. That takes a, you know what? That takes bigger stones probably than to finish a game in the ninth inning of a major league, in a major league ballpark.
And it's understandable for that reason, even though people get, or players get incredible grief when the odd times that they just don't do it, you understand why the emotions might be running too high for them to show up at that particular moment.
Sure. Yeah, you do. But again, it's, and the other side is, it's part of the job. I mean, it's
true.
If you're going to celebrate in the victories, then you have to be willing to face the music and the losses. And, you know, I know that there tends to be, you know, a lot of focus on, well, who cares what the players say after the game, or who cares about this and this? Well, there's also something to be said for accountability. And I know, because I've been fortunate to work with front office guys, that they pay attention to that. They understand, they are watching to see whether or not their guys stand up when the spotlight is the brightest on them, you know, in not necessarily in a positive way, but in an inquisitive way, because they want to see whether or not they can truly handle that pressure.
You bring up a really good point about the nature of postgame interviews, and there's a, I'm going to go with a predictable Casey Stengel anecdote here, but there's a famous one as the Yankees were losing the 1957 World Series to the Milwaukee Braves. In one of the postgames, a TV reporter went up to Casey Stengel and said, do you feel your team is choking? And Casey said, I don't know. Do you choke on that fucking microphone? And then he turned around and he scratched his ass so that the picture would be ruined. I always thought about that as maybe a bit juvenile, but listening to what you're saying, I kind of think, what did that reporter think he was going to get?
Well, he was trying to provoke him, clearly. And Casey, in that point, is standing up for his players, you know, which is what you want a boss to do, right? I mean, you want your boss to have your back. So, I mean, that's, I get it from Casey's standpoint, too. You know, I read about 10 years ago or so, John Feinstein wrote a book about Red Auerbach. Apparently, Feinstein had become friends with Auerbach in Auerbach's later years, and he used to have these lunches, like, weekly at this Chinese restaurant in D.C., and, you know, Auerbach was still involved at GW at the time, and it would be, you know, anywhere from like 4 to like 15 people. And I think Chris Wallace, Mike Wallace's son, who's one of the news reporters on Fox News, was usually part of it, and there was a huge group of them. But one of the things that John estimated from this book was Auerbach was really good at, when his team lost a game, he basically gave the reporters all the time that they wanted. He did everything he could to answer every single question to keep them away from the players. When they won, he tried to be as short as possible so that they would go in there and that the players could have the glory. And I always thought that was really smart. And I thought that there were, you know, I've seen some managers that have done that to some degree over the years in baseball. I always felt Ozzie Guillen was really good at that. Like, if after a loss, would talk to you for forever. He would give you, I mean, Ozzie was a quote machine anyway. I think some people see it as grandstanding and showboating, but the more time that you're spending – with the manager, the less time there is to ask the players difficult questions, and it helps to protect them some. And I thought, always have thought, that that was a fairly brilliant strategy from Auerbach.
Absolutely. And, I mean, Casey was normally famous for romancing the writers and taking them out to dinner and drinking with them and so on. But I guess when you're put on the spot that way, that anybody can react badly.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask, too, about the post-game aspect of this, because I've heard less of the post-game, and I don't know if you're taking calls at all in addition to what you're doing.
No, our post-game's pretty short.
It's pretty short. So one of the interesting things, and I know you have experience from doing this on Sirius XM also, was that he would have to manage people's expectations. So I would be listening in, say, 1986, which, as you know, was kind of a seminal year for the Mets.
Sure.
And they might drop, you know, the one game they drop all month, and he would do all the post-game stuff, and then he would take calls, and people would say, you know, I'm very concerned about the way the team is going. And he would say, they're up by 12 games. And then, you know, the next call would say, you know, I really think Keith Hernandez is done. And, you know, he went 0 for 5 tonight and he stranded a lot of runners. And I think the team needs to make a change. And he'd say, he's hitting 330 and leading the team in RBIs. What do you want? It's a good question to ask you, even if you're not taking calls, because you've been doing this on the Sirius XM end, certainly, for a long time. Like, you are helping to set people's mood and expectation and outlook for their various teams. Just with Sirius, you're doing it for 30 teams. With the Diamondbacks, I'm sure that you get the opportunity to do it very often for that one.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that's one of the real challenges, is that, you know, so I always think that there's some similarity between the people who react on Twitter to the people who call in to post-game shows. You know what I mean? Like, there is a visceral reaction when you give a damn, right?
Right.
And it's the same thing that we were just talking about with the players and managers, like having to talk 10 minutes after a game. Well, you, of course your emotions are raw after a team loses, especially if you lose to a team that you feel like your team shouldn't, right? You can be ticked off as a fan. There's only the biggest difference is that there is less level of control, right? And I have found myself over the years more than once getting frustrated by those kinds of calls. And well, let's use Mets fans as an example, because I do think that for the most part, Mets fans who call radio shows tend to be ones who are emotional in their reaction, right? And I think that that's, and I'm not trying to knock Mets fans because I think they're great fans, but that they do tend to be emotive. And everything is the end of the world, you know, even when they're winning. Now, they certainly can find any dark cloud around a silver lining, too, when they call in. But, you know, I do think that the biggest thing is that, and you know, we're kind of preaching to the converted here, I think, but baseball's every day, right? I mean, this ain't football. We do it every day, right? Wasn't that the Earl Weaver line? So one game doesn't mean nearly as much as it does in football. 10 games, you know, means about as much as it does in football, right? If you lost 10 in a row, that's a time to really worry. 10-game losing streaks don't happen to good teams very often. You know, 6 and 7 game ones may, but that to lose 10 in a row, I mean, that's, you're basically Rosencrantz and Gilderstern flipping the coin and having it come up heads 140 times in a row, right?
You read my mind.
So
you absolutely read my mind.
So, I mean, I think that part of it when you're hosting a program like that is finding ways to allow people to vent without kind of being a jerk back to them. And I struggle with that sometimes because you just, you know, you feel like there are some people who are just jerks. And then the only way to handle them is to just vent a little bit back at them, right? But for the most part, people just want to be heard. They want you to understand what they're going through, right? That they want somebody to empathize with them because they care as much about the team as you do, and they have less control over what's going on. So, well, not that, well, I don't know that they have less control, but they have less control than certainly than the players that are on the field or the managers or the coaches or whatever. So they want to find, you know, they want an explanation. They want to find someone to blame. And I think it's just a matter of how you explain things, you know. And I think that this extends beyond just pre and post game callers. I think this is something that we've seen as the analysis of baseball has gotten smarter or better, is that there is a lack of willingness to understand that people want to know. They don't want to be told. They want to understand. And as a result, you know, I think a lot of the analysis comes off way snarkier than it should. I had I won't mention his name, but this was several years ago. I had a mutual friend of ours who was listening to a post-game show while I was trying to explain something about FIP to a caller or something like that. And he was like, I don't know how you handle this. This guy clearly didn't get it. And I was like, man, he just wants to know, right? He doesn't know. How can you get angry at somebody who is trying to learn, who might have a new concept? And I think it's the same thing that, and again, I'm not always real good at it. It's trying to remember that with people who are calling to vent frustrations after, you know, team loses two or three in a row. It's like, hey, you know, you got to take a step back. You got to look at the bigger picture, but it's really difficult to do that inside the moment.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And it's something that I've always told writers who I've worked with, you know, no respect to Baseball Prospectus or FanGraphs or any of those sites. You and I both consume those things and are fans of that kind of thing because we want to know what's going on. But you don't always have to show your work. You don't always have to include the theory of relativity in your explanation.
Sure.
You can just tell them what's going on. And if they want to do the homework later, fine. But in the time that you have, whether it's an 800-word column or 3 minutes between commercials on the...
Yeah, and I think I do think that's important. But if they're willing to, if they want to ask questions about it, you need to be willing to answer them. You know what I mean? I mean, that's how we all gain information, right? But I also think that you don't need to assume that your audience can't handle the information that you're giving them. You know, I mean, I think that there's a lot that people are afraid to put out onto a broadcast because they're worried that their audience won't get it.
But which is the more effective delivery? And I really am curious about this, and because you do talk to a mass audience, right? And that mass audience includes people who are incredibly well-versed in arcane stats and people who are still looking at the back of the baseball card and, you know, like you and I did, looking at the newspaper every Sunday back when we were kids, seeing average and home runs and RBIs, and that's it. If you know, and I'll just use, you know, Zach Greinke as an example because we were talking about him before, that Greinke's ERA at a given moment is 4, but you've looked at FIP, fielding independent pitching, and you know that it should be 3. If somebody calls in to complain about Greinke, and you are going to say, you're going to put his mind at ease, and you're going to say there are two ways of handling it. You can say, look, he's going to be okay because the defense hasn't performed behind him, and it should, given time, rebound. Now, you don't need to mention FIP in that answer. You know it because of FIP. That's your homework. That's your research off the air. You could include FIP, but you risk, I think, and again, this is a weird position for me, having been editor-in-chief of Baseball Prospectus, to be preaching. You can do it both ways, but I wonder if you don't need to have FIP in there, in some cases you're better off leaving it out and just conveying the takeaway.
Well, there's, you know, a couple of options. They're either going to or they won't. And maybe they won't care either way. You know, in the end, your goal is still to entertain. And so I think we can be a little bit too fearful of trying to include information, especially if you were talking about better ways to evaluate players statistically. I think that there's this great fear that you're going to somehow alienate the masses. And in the end, you know, as long as you're still talking about the game or whatever, that's not going to alienate the masses, because really all they care about is the game. And whether you have decided to quote that Joe Schmo has 86 RBI or that his win probability added in big spots is, you know, one of the best in the league, they don't give a damn either way.
That's what I'm trying to say. You can do both, but you can limit.
Yeah, well, that's what I try and do. I mean, that's as much as possible is, you know, okay, well, so in your example, let's say Greinke has a 4 ERA, right? And his FIP is closer to 3. Well, what are the elements that make up fielding independent pitching, right? Lack of home runs allowed, strikeout rate, walk rate, ground ball percentage, right? Is that included in FIP or just Sierra at any rate? You know, those are the issues, right? Those are the things that are good at run prevention at the very least, right? It's talking more about those. I mean, understanding that a guy doesn't walk many hitters, that he, you know, he's striking out batter an inning. And I know, you know, strikeout percentage is probably more important, but, you know, sometimes if you're just doing quick and dirty, that works. Those are elements that everybody can understand, right? We have those numbers at our disposal, and they don't necessarily need to know what FIP is. And a big thing is that you just don't need to use numbers very much. I try very hard not to use many statistics really at all. And, you know, I think I would argue that I think if well, I'd be actually curious if somebody did this, if they were to record a week's worth of programming on Sirius and find out which one of our hosts uses numbers the most. I use, you know, OPS plus ERA plus probably more than anything to compare where somebody is to league average. But I really feel like I try and talk about the concepts that go into it more, because if I'm listening on the radio, so this I get to spend a little bit of time with Dan Dickerson, the Tigers play-by-play guy this week. And Dan is one of my favorites. And one of the reasons why Dan is one of my favorites is that he understands the concepts that go into advanced metrics, but he doesn't tell you a number unless it's really important. If I'm listening to a game or watching a game and an announcer is just listing off a whole bunch of stats, it's word salad to me. It doesn't matter. I can't process it if I'm passively listening to a game on the radio. I just can't. And so if you give me one number that really, really matters about a player, that the announcer thinks is important, because I think we have to walk into it with some assumption, and I know what happens when we assume, but some assumption that the announcer is working from a little bit of a position of authority in this, that if they give one number that is important to them in that spot, it's going to have a much more lasting impact with your audience than if you're to list a whole bunch of different things. Now, I say this, and this is after I spent 5 minutes going through expected WOBAs and exit velocities for like 4 minutes on Andrew McCutchen the other day on Sirius. But that was kind of the point of the segment, more than if you're just talking about players, and whether you're doing a game or you're doing, you know, a talk show, then just give me what's most important. And because too many numbers just become numbers.
Well, it's like if you were writing a story and you go all Charles Dickens and spend 5 pages describing the drapes, you know, it gets in the way of the plot. It gets in the way of what's actually happening.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So can I put you on the spot just slightly, because
sure.
I'm curious about something. As someone who has listened to you quite a bit, but I suspect, and I'm only going here because you mentioned this before, that sometimes as a guy who takes calls, you get a call that you don't really want, or that, you know, the guy doesn't really have a point, or he's inane, or he's boring. And I suspect, and I am not, as your friend, I am not going to tell you what this is, because you will self-monitor and it will ruin you. And I don't want to be responsible for that because I enjoy you too much. I think you have certain tells when you're not actually listening to the call.
Probably.
If you've read about actors, say when they're on stage and they're doing a show night after night, they're not paying attention to the other actor after a while. They're listening to the cadence of the dialogue. They're not thinking, as a prince of Denmark, I will avenge my father's murder. While the other person is talking, what they're thinking is, you know, when I get out of here, I'd really like some tandoori chicken.
Right.
And I've got to do the laundry and stop by the drugstore. And so I wonder if you ever have moments like that.
Absolutely. But I don't think it's just callers. First of all, we don't take many calls on our show. The ones we do tend to be on point because we have outstanding producers. Hunter Reiser, who screens our calls, does a tremendous job of keeping people on point. I think that that's really important. I think that that's really important to having compelling conversations with the audience when it comes to callers, is having somebody who is a producer who understands the importance of keeping people in line. And Hutter's tremendous at that. I shouldn't say in line, but on topic. And not necessarily, you know, sometimes he'll throw one in to provoke, but certainly somebody who has a point. And he's not afraid to say, we're not going to take your call, because it doesn't either make sense or fit what we're talking about or have a real clear point to it. We're not going to just take the call to take the call. I think he deserves a lot of credit for that. But even more so than with callers, like, I tune out Duquette sometimes, you know? Like, I may get a tweet in the middle of something that Jim's saying, and I'll get distracted, right? I mean, and he does it too. I know he does it too, because we joke about it, right? It happens. And yeah, the problem is that you've got to suddenly recover from it, right? So absolutely, there are tells. I think if you listened close enough, you could hear the tells. And I'm sure that there's probably some callers that you can hear when I put them up that right away play, it's like, oh boy, here we go. But there's also some times where you're going to hear Jim say something and I'm going to end up repeating it right back to him because I have no idea what he just said. And the worst part is when you're doing an interview, right? And this happens to all of us. The last thing you want to do is ask the same question that your partner asked. Right? You may tune out for a second. Like a lot of times I'll be looking at my notes for an interview and I'll try and see where I want to go next while Jim's asking a question. And sometimes I'll be doing that and I'll get so focused on my notes that I'll miss what Jim said. And I'll be worried that he's asked the guy what I want to ask next. And then you're going, oh no, what did I do? Right? Like, what do I do? So then you're texting your producer and going, what did he ask about? And hoping that they get back to you before the next question. Then you're hoping you can move on to something else and maybe come back to that. So, there's definitely tells because, especially now, I'm curious what being a talk show host was like before you had the distractions of the internet, because I think that probably has hurt it some. But at the same time, I relish the interaction mid-show, mid-interview with people on Twitter, too. I love that. I'm the one guy who loves Twitter. I love it. I love that interaction probably more than I love the interaction on the phones because it's succinct. You know, it's generally from people who are listening and, you know, who are able to make good points quickly. So I think that that's the other part of that challenge with it.
The one thing that you do that's very honest, which I appreciate, is you don't pretend that you have all the knowledge at your fingertips. And there have been countless times, and I'm sure it's every show, multiple times a show, where someone will make a comment about a player and you'll say you're bringing up the baseball reference page. You don't just pop out with the stats. You say, huh, let me see this is what it is. There, you give it a human moment of kind of controlled fumfering before you get to the information.
Well, it's because I don't know anything. I mean, really. I'm just a talk show host in the end. You know, it's not like I'm an executive or charged to know everything about every player. You know, I'm supposed to. I feel like if you didn't have notes in front of me, I would at least be able to give you a pretty good idea of 98% of the players who are in baseball and maybe have either a story or know something about their, you know, pitcher stuff or what their kind of scouting report is. The 2% might be a struggle, you know, from time to time. But if you ask me about it, I'm going to try and learn about it real quick because I think knowledge is power and I really like to know things. I mean, that's my big thing is I want to know more information. I want to try and get smarter every day. I ask a lot of questions of people because I want to learn as much as anything. And I'm interested in you know, figuring out, you know, what I don't know.
No, it's false pride to pretend otherwise, to pretend that you know everything. And I will candidly admit that certainly there was a time up to fairly recently where I probably could give you something succinct, a bullet point at least about every player in the major leagues. But now that bullpens are so huge and that last guy turns over so often because he kind of taxis up and down at AAA, sometimes I lose track of that last member of the pitching staff.
Right, right. Like Richard Blyer, I think, is called up today for Baltimore. I can tell you he's left-handed and with some degree of confidence, I can tell you that. And I believe came from the Yankees, right? I mean, that might be about all I have.
Yes.
And I'm not sure that either of those things are accurate, but I feel good enough to say it on this podcast. He is left-handed.
I'll check after we're done. And
I got that part right. And he did come from the Yankees. So yes. There we go. So
we can always loop it. I'll just dub in your Giants. Or
yes, right. The Atlanta Falcons. Right. No, I mean, it's like, and sometimes it's just having those little bits of things that you know, matter enough. At least it makes it seem like you're on point even when you're not, which the more I can fool them, the longer I'll stay employed.
Well, I mean, the great thing, and I know you have to get to the ballpark, so I'll make this the last question. I mean, I could talk to you for hours, as we have talked for
we used to.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes almost at gunpoint. Yeah, I'm sure you remember that there were times that, for whatever reason, they said stretch, like go to 2-3 a.m., because that's important for some reason.
Oh, boy, yeah.
You were just talking about this, the ability to recover when you come back. One of the benefits of my doing this, and we time release it, is that if I trip over my tongue, which when I record my introductions, I do constantly, so that the tape of it, the virtual tape of it, looks like it's been sliced into a million little pieces as I cut in. You can't do that. And when you're doing, whether you're doing a pregame show or play-by-play or the SiriusXM show, you can't screw up and rewind and go back. And I wonder, this is purely a technique question in a way, and maybe, you know, unlike me, you're not about to go off an Alexa-Pro-induced haze all the time, but how do you keep so smooth so that you're not in that position of making a constant blooper reel effectively?
Well, I don't think I'm particularly smooth. I mean, you can catch a lot of vocalized pauses in everything that I do. So I think that's, you know, I don't necessarily think of myself that way. I guess I'm not afraid to make a mistake, you know? I mean, that's, you know, what's the worst thing that happens in radio is what? Well, I mean, other than dropping an F-bomb, but which I've done once, but it's dead air, right? So if you need to gather yourself for a second, okay, well, that's not the end of the world.
Right.
You know, if you lose your train of thought, you know, admit that you lose your train of thought. The Private Parts movie came out when I can't remember what year was that. Would that have been like 96 or 97, something like that. So it was right as I had my first job in radio. And I was reading a lot of books about kind of personality radio. I had a great boss, Paul Hemmer, who hired me, who's still the single most important person in my professional career. And he had given me a bunch of books on personality radio, and some of it had talked a little bit about Stern, and I was never, and still am not really a Stern listener. But there's a moment in that, I think when he's in Hartford and he loses the copy for a commercial and just starts making it up about the sporting goods store, right, and how he used to shop right there all the time, and then he finds the copy and he's like, and I've been caught in the lie, right? And his wife says to him, you know, that was real. That was the moment, you know, that was the best part of the show. That always kind of stuck with me, because it's like, I mean, why try and fake it? You know, I mean, there's going to be times where you screw up. And so there's a couple things you can do. You can either rewind yourself, or, you know, take a deep breath and move on to the next thing, or, you know, hopefully admit that you're wrong. You know, don't keep going down the path of keeping a lie going or a half-truth going because you didn't have the right information. If you make a mistake, move on. Don't draw too much attention to it, but move on. Right. And I think that's you know, probably works in any industry. I think the people who are successful in any industry do that. I mean, if you write a piece that you go, man, that sucks, you can't dwell on it. You have to write something else the next day.
Twitter has changed that a little, in that one of my last pieces at SB Nation, I wrote something about the Royals losing the World Series and how they had to change their approach or they weren't going to be back. And then I disappeared for a year and they won the World Series. And at that point, as I wanted to hear nothing from anybody, certainly nothing critical, as I was trying to kind of rediscover my joy at doing this, Twitter users discovered that column, and I woke up every day for about a week to a torrent of people calling me an idiot over and over and over again. And unfortunately, I didn't have a platform to say, look, here's why I thought that was accurate at the time. Here's why it in fact was accurate. I was just off by a year in terms of what the faults were with the team. And I've subsequently written that piece, and I've subsequently answered those people on Twitter. But you're right. You have to go back to it right away, because people will ram it down your throat now if you let something that seems errant live.
But that's not necessarily a bad thing either. I mean, we should be accountable. You know, if you have opinions, your opinions are supposed to be based in fact, right?
So absolutely,
you need to be accountable. In this age of hot take discourse, I think it gets lost a lot that reasonable people can disagree, you know?
Right.
I mean, I still think it's crazy that the Royals hit Alcides Escobar leadoff. I would bet that 90% of the baseball population thinks it's crazy,
yep,
that Alcides Escobar hits leadoff. For some reason, the Royals are a better team when Alcides Escobar hits leadoff. That's in the record, right? I mean, and again, it's a zero-sum game. You either win or lose, right? So you know, the Royals continue to benefit from that, and it doesn't make any sense. And I still look at their lineup and go, my God, how can you put him in the leadoff spot, and at the same time they keep doing it? And it doesn't make me mad that I'm wrong about it, or that, you know, or it's not going to make me gloat if all of a sudden they start losing when Alcides Escobar is there. There's a lot of different ways to look at this. We're all fighting over a very small segment of the analytical landscape, right? Or of any piece of landscape and analysis. I love disagreeing with people, and I love having discussions with people, not arguments, but discussion with people about, you know, what might be wrong. And I may, you know, be, you know, dig my heels in on a position, but it doesn't mean I'm not going to think about what they said. And a lot of times I'm wrong. I'm probably wrong more than I'm right. You know, I mean, it's, you know, baseball analysis is a game of failure.
Right. That's the nature of predictions. You make them and you hope that they're informed, but they don't always come true. And then, you know, you have to say why. I mean, that's why they play the proverbial games. And this is a whole other discussion, and we can have this another time. But I suspect you're not wrong about El Cid's Escobar. It's just in a way that a 3 or 5 year sample in some ways is small, and that it's not unlike the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern example you used before of the coin coming up heads. They've just had that particular outcome, that counterintuitive outcome, for a period of years. And it's just an example of sustained luck. It's not necessarily evidence that you or I or the 90% of the baseball public isn't understanding something.
Well, but it also doesn't mean that we're right. I mean, what if there's something to his aggressive nature at the plate that helps change the mindset of the players behind him? That it's like if he's up there and he's swinging at the first pitch and he rifles a base hit, that gets something that's not easy for us to quantify flowing.
Well, maybe.
Right? For the rest of the lineup? Then is it, I mean, maybe that's, you know, because that's certainly what it seems like when you listen to the Royals kind of talk about it. Maybe that's real. You know, that's what we're dealing with are the hard science kind of facts of statistical analysis. And what we are still really crappy at is dealing with the human element of it, right? I mean, it's unless we're Russell Carlton because he's a damn genius.
But he is. For it.
But like the rest of us are just really poor at that. You know, does lineup, does clubhouse chemistry matter? Well, yeah, like any workplace dynamic, it matters. Does it outweigh the talent of the people that you work with in whatever industry you're in? No. But people who are in a happier workplace tend to be more productive, right? So does winning beget that, or does culture beget winning? I mean, these are all questions, or these are all, you know, chicken and the egg type stuff that we deal with in any industry. Why should baseball be any different? We're all human beings.
No, it shouldn't. And it, I mean, we could keep going with that. I mean, and I could say, you know, if I hang a troll doll from my rearview mirror and I've never been in an accident as long as that's hanging there, that certainly that troll doll has made me a better driver. But I mean, I don't know. But again, I'm very conscious of not inconveniencing you. And you know, I know it's hours away, but somehow the game starts without you and you're in trouble. So let me just leave you with this thought. Because I'm very grateful for you fitting me in, because you really are the hardest working man in show business in some ways.
Hardly.
As you grow in this role, and you do, I hope, get to do more play by play, because I know that that's something that you want to do. Can I give you my prayer, my heartfelt prayer that you do not ever invent a canned home run call? Because I have just had. You know, I'm kind of beyond fandom now, but there were, when I did have my heart invested in the Yankees, there were just too many games where they were trailing in the ninth inning and someone hit a fly ball. And what I heard was, it is high, it is far, it is goff the wall. And I don't know what word in the English language is goff, but I don't want to see, I care about you too much to see you do that to yourself.
Thank you. I don't think you have to worry about that. I don't know that. I mean, who knows? Maybe I'll come up with something that's, you know, like I'll start dropping a bazinga in there or something, but I'll wait till the ball lands. How's that?
Shazam. Yeah. Any of that. It is probably not. I think unpredictable is better. That's my feeling.
I mean,
Mike, thank you.
Well, you know, Susan, you can't predict baseball.
Oh my goodness gracious, Mike. Thank you so much for doing this and again for taking the time, and I hope we get to do it down the road, and I look forward to hopefully running into you somewhere in actual reality at some point.
I'll be in New York in August, so I do hope that I get to see you then. So it's great to be with you, my friend.
Hey, real quick before we kick off the ending credits in earnest, I just want to clarify one small thing. Just in case any kids are listening, or anyone is listening for that matter, I said at the episode's outset that I listen to Mike while driving and then text him. I do want to make it clear that I do stop the car. I do pull over. I do not text while driving, because that would be unwise. I know that because Jiminy Cricket told me so. When I was a kid, they used to broadcast repeats of the old Mickey Mouse Club show from the 1950s, and Jiminy Cricket would sing this song.
Any fool will load his bike so much that he can't see. He rides on sidewalks, so what happens? A catastrophe.
Oh, I'm no fool.
No siree. I want to live to be 93.
I play safe for you and me, cause I'm no fool.
Show off is a...
He also had some songs about looking both ways before you cross the street and... not doing heroin for all I know, but here's the problem with all that. That was Cliff Edwards, Ukulele Ike. He had a long career starting in vaudeville. He was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and he died broke and alone. I guess those who can't do teach, but I in this case, can do. That is, I don't do. That is, I strongly implore you not to drive and text, because that's a really dumb way to arrange your own funeral. We'd better get on with the closing credits before Disney sues me, having gotten them in twice this week. This has been episode 4, and many thanks to Mike Farren for dropping by. If you want more of Mike, subscribe to SiriusXM. What are you waiting for? They've got a whole channel devoted to talking baseball pretty much 24 hours a day, and now they have a whole channel devoted exclusively to the Beatles. I mean, Mike Farren and the Beatles, the Titanic team-up that you demanded. Who could ask for anything more? Wait, that's not the Beatles, that's Gershwin. But I digress. You can follow Mike on Twitter at Mike _ Farren. And you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Hey, if I keep saying it, I might actually go one day. You never know. You can also read me 3 times a week at fanrag.com. We have no sponsor yet, but hope springs eternal. And in the meantime, we're brought to you by the number 21. Our producer is a small hedgehog named Gertrude, and she has no thumbs! The music you've heard throughout this episode was written by me and Richard Mooring, who I've known since he was this high. Assuming Ty Cobb doesn't slash me with his spikes, next week we'll pick up our starting rotation of co-hosts with Jesse Spector, and he and I will have more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.